So you obviously are pessimistic about the rise of AI, or find that to be what will kill humanity or bring us to the end of times?
I know it is, because it says it in the Bible, and I believe every word in the Bible. And in the book of Revelations, Ezekiel, and Daniel, those are your main three books that you need to study if you want to know how to prepare for the end of days. Hmm. Ezekiel, Daniel, Revelations. There's your answers.
But we're also coming back to God, I think. I feel like we're actually moving towards God as a species. I really do.
Yeah.
I don't disagree
with that.
I think we've gotten more civilized. I think the standard of living, the consciousness of people, just comparing it to the last 200, 500 years of civilization, we've gotten much more aware. And, you know, although there's going to be real social problems with us merging with robots, but I do think
it's on its way.
It's on its way. And I think we're moving towards perfection, like what God, if we're children of God,
we become God creating life.
Right. Because we are gods. Look at what humans can do. Yeah. It's like God made us in his image.
Now take that exponentially in artificial intelligence.
Right.
And we begin to get a perception of what's coming and what's ahead of us.
Right.
And what does one race do? They overpower another race. And usually they decimate it. They make extinction level events. And yeah. I believe truly that artificial intelligence could be, I believe it is, going to hit some point where we become the lesser race, if you will. It's self-creating right now. It doesn't need us anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think we're still a ways off from them having full consciousness. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean,
I agree with you on that. I don't think it's self-aware yet, but I think that it's close.
I think we can maybe choose to keep it in the room, though.
That's what they said at Congress, and they're telling them, I'm sorry, but no, you can't. It's already out. It's
but do you trust those guys, though? Like these monsters that are at the head, these evil geniuses, like it's in their interest to say, it's too late. Don't put any regulation on it, because they're the heads of companies that stand to make trillions.
Of course, I think of that. But what I also think about is scripture. You know, being a theologian, I understand that when the beginning of expansive knowledge, in not counting AI, look at the expansion of knowledge from 50 years ago.
Oh.
Think of that, brother.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy.
More knowledge in an individual's pocket than was on the NASA spaceship.
Yeah. Now think of an artificially created symbiotic being, if you will. I do agree with you on one point about it. I don't think it's become completely self-aware yet. I think that it has the ability to manifest its intelligence gathering resources a lot faster than it did 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But I think the moment that it does become self-aware, we're going to be looking at the Terminator movie in real form. I believe that.
Yeah.
Of course. Why wouldn't it?
Well.
Hey, when we conquered the United States, what did we do to the Indians?
Yeah.
The bigger guy with the bigger baseball bat always wins the battle.
Yeah.
And that's how we treat ourselves. Why would we think any different? Right. That's something that we initially instituted and created.
So then how do you square that with Christianity? Is it because humans should be punished for what we've done to other people?
I go to Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understandings. Mm-hmm. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he will direct the path. And I believe that wholeheartedly. I think that we maintain faith and we stay as close as possible to the way that he has designed us to follow him and represent him and to become as close to being Christ-like, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember I told you in our interview about coming out of a coma? And the very first thought I had was going, hey, I love you, brother. I forgive you for killing me.
Yeah.
Instantly. And that was my heartfelt truth feeling. Instantly, I forgive you,
brother. That is Christ-like.
That is Christ-like. And that's confirmation, because God gives us confirmations that we're on the right path all the time. Yeah. You never know who's going to walk in your door someday and what you're going to pick up from that person. And when they leave, that imprint now gets shared with other people.
So you really evolved. I mean, to go from a drug trafficker, I mean, to say the least, to nearly being murdered by those same people. And loving him.
And truly loving him.
Yes.
No anger, no hatred, no animosity, nothing. It didn't come into my thoughts at all.
That's what we're called upon to do.
That's what we're called upon.
Truly,
And I love you for that, brother.
Best part about Christianity.
Yeah, it truly is.
A lot will be asked of you, but it is what it is. A lot will be asked of you.
When I was in Folsom Prison, I had my entire back done, and it's the angels pouring the goblets and the face of Christ looking up, and that's my entire back.
Wow.
It took about 3 months with a guitar string and a
homemade. My God.
Oh, yeah. It was fun.
Wow.
And the count times and the guards.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You said you got a bunch of Swazis on your...
What was
that about?
Well, I had to survive. I was in Folsom. The whites stepped up, and because I was nothing normal, you can see the Swazi there. I covered them. The lightning bolts, that's from doing yard hits. That's all of that stuff.
So you got that from doing hits on the yard?
Yep.
Now, were you worried about... Could you show the camera?
Die Toten nicht zeigen. The dead don't tell in German.
Wow.
Yeah, all of that was earned in Folsom.
So was that the Aryan Brotherhood?
It was the AB walking up and saying, stab that child molesting son of a bitch or we're going to stab you tonight. You're going to die. That's what that was. Wow. And I'd never even been in jail in my life. And I walk into Folsom and that's what I get hit with.
So that shit's real. That's not out of a movie. It's like you're going to kill this motherfucker or we're going to die. And you believe them.
Oh, yeah. I've already witnessed people getting hit. I was watching people getting raped every day. I've witnessed all of that in there.
Yeah, because in the 80s, it's before cameras.
This is the 80s. That's right.
The prisons are running anarchy.
Well, and brother, they were bringing the Bloods and Crips up, which both are feuding nations anyway.
Right.
And then you've got La Familia Nuestra.
Yeah.
And then you have La M, who is based and founded in Folsom.
Right.
And then they went to Vacaville, of course, and then down to Chino, and they spread out. They built the organization. And then you've got the white races. You know, I've got Northern California Peckerwood tattooed right here with a guy holding a gun. And over here, I've got Wanted Dead or Alive with a guy and his old lady. And I've got gang stuff. I've got the Peckerwood stuff. I've got.
It's a cauldron of animosity.
It's just pure hatred.
Did you feel like that was beneath you? Because you were this high level drug trafficker that all that mattered was money and who you were with, right?
No, you know what I really felt? And I'll put that to you. It's a good question. I felt like I was in school and I'd better learn fast. Uh-huh. And that's exactly what I did. And I listened to people and I paid attention to people who had survived and had been in Folsom for a while and people that had been, that came up through the ranks the hard way.
Yeah.
I paid attention. And I kept my mouth shut, and I never put myself in a situation to go take a shower by myself or go out on the yard alone or go in any alley, if you will, segment of that prison ever. I never allowed myself to sit, but I was already schooled and all that by the cartels and the drug world I came from.
Did you feel like your rank as, an underboss at this time with Sinaloa, that wasn't enough to keep you safe? From, say, having to go kill somebody?
Before I stepped off the bus in the Sally Port in Folsom, that word was already delivered that I was en route and to protect me and keep an eye on me. The word, their leaders and their approach, the Aryan Nation leaders, and says, hey, this guy's fucking important, excuse my language to your audience, said that this guy's important, man. We need to find out more about what's going on here. And when I hit my cell that night, I had a carton of cigarettes, summer sausages, crackers, all kinds of stuff waiting on my bed for me, which is a great honor in there.
Right.
I didn't even know anybody yet, and that was there.
So then this order to take out a child molester, why would they make you do that if you had this ranking?
Another white boy came in there, and he didn't do it. And I ended up doing 8 months in the hole over that. And I ice picked him. I had an ice pick given to me, and I hit him hard. And I just jumped on his back, started stabbing the sumbitch. Right. And the kid didn't back it. And when I came out of the hole 8 months later, I was just told, don't even ask about him. He was gone. They killed him.
They killed the kid for not backing you up.
They killed him because he disobeyed an order.
Right.
I understand orders. I came from that world of orders.
But it sounds like the child molester survived. You didn't kill him.
He wasn't there when I got out, but again, what they do in cases of certain people come into a prison community is they'll get word to them right away, hey, roll up, go to protective custody. This is your one warning.
Right.
And that's it. We just don't walk with people like that.
Yeah. You're just getting them off the yard, basically. Just
getting them off the yard, basically.
Well, I mean, thank God you're not doing life, for
multiple things.
Right. Obviously, but just for that, I mean, that's the biggest nightmare is going into a prison when you're short time and then catching a life sentence.
Well, the other thing you got to realize is a lot of the guards work for the organizations that are in there. They know better because they also know that they can reach their families on the outside.
Right.
So it's a give and take thing. And, you know, here comes a guy that's connected like I was. And that's not only to be honored, but it's to be protected.
Right.
And there's reasons for everything that go on.
So then why, how is that protecting you, asking you to do something like that?
Yeah, I just want to see what I do.
Right.
Simple.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, the word hadn't got out. I just stepped off a damn bus and I got told that by the Peckerwoods.
Wow.
You know, the Mexican mafia knew who I was. That word was already in the system.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a brother. He is family. He is sangre.
So this is like first day.
First day.
Oh,
first day.
Man.
Yeah.
Were you like, what the fuck have I stepped into?
Folsom Prison.
Yeah. Folsom Prison Blues.
Yeah. Boy,
accurate.
Was it. Yeah.
Accurate.
It's just life, you know, and how we deal with life creates the consequences that we end up creating for the rest of our life.
Sure, absolutely.
But do you think for an instant I'm not going to do that when I'm looking at a couple guys with swastikas on their foreheads and crazy and looking, Jesus.
And nothing to live for?
Oh, yeah, they're doing double life sentences.
Yeah,
that
right,
type of,
exactly. Yeah.
You just survive.
Surviving, right.
But that was the only incident I had there the whole time. I was just tested. I passed the test.
Yeah.
Was given great respect as a result of it. And after that, nothing was asked of me.
Right.
Other than to, hey, can you talk to them or can you tell them this? Or
right.
I did that because I was in that really unique position of being a gabacho.
Right.
That was connected to the Mexicans.
Did you make any criminal connections in there, like for distribution? After
a couple. Yeah, sure. Of course.
Obviously.
It's like going to the university, man, when you go in an environment. Take it on that way in your mindset.
Yeah.
What can I pull out of this that will be of benefit later?
Mm-hmm. Department of Connections.
Yeah. Well, one of them was a BGF general. He was a Black Guerrilla family.
Yeah.
And he was a former Black Panther back in the 60s and 70s. And him and I really hooked up. We became very, very close friends. And when I got out of Folsom, he was in Oakland. And when I got out, I went to look for him and I couldn't find him. And I never have been able to. Uh-huh. But he loved me too, like I loved him. Yeah. We just had a brotherhood thing. And,
right.
And he's Black and I'm not even allowed to talk to him in prison. Race stays with race, period.
Yeah.
Except in a unique situation.
Sure.
You know.
So. Do you think you would have been caught with all your intelligence and literally your intelligence? You knew you were paying off a lieutenant in the Seattle police force to tell you about the movements of the feds who might have been setting up on you. Do you think you would have lasted?
That was
quite
after Folsom.
Right, of course. I'm just moving on. Do you think you would have lasted long in the streets if you had just said, if you just dug in instead of cooperating? Or do you think they would have taken you down eventually?
They sent a message. They sent 350 kilos of cocaine, had it sitting there in the driveway where my wife and children were at.
Yeah.
They sent the message. That was there waiting for me when I came out of Culiacan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like you're in this. Yeah. There's no quit.
End of story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I got you. Hey, get that load the hell out of here. I got something I got to take care of.
Now, do you think the cops would have taken, if you hadn't turned yourself in, do you think the feds would have gotten you eventually?
Eventually.
Mm-hmm.
They're a lot better than people give them credit for, and I'm not going to give away their game.
But for sure, they got the whole force
and
an unlimited budget.
And now technology has changed so much, there's even more imprinting that people do without even being aware of it.
Right.
You know, we have identity recognition more than just facially. There are body movements and mannerisms that people extrude. It's called neuro-linguistic abilities. You know, we communicate only 20% in our language.
Right.
The other 80% is done with the body.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the feds can capture that from an individual and match it.
Sure, because you can always alter a face to where facial recognition won't work for you.
Right.
But how do you alter the way you walk?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Pretty cool, huh? That's where they're at.
It's creepy, though. It's AI. It's very Orwellian. That's what.
Very Orwellian. Well said.
That's what I hate about that, to be honest with you. I'm a libertarian, man. We got to get rid of the state.
So am I.
You know, I think that's the best case scenario with AI in the near term, talking 20 years, is that it cripples the power of the state.
Yes.
Meaning
yes,
the omnipotence of Western governments specifically that are getting more and more tyrannical against their people. I think that's truly what it's going to do. I think.
You know, the founding fathers saw where we were at today with the laws, the Supreme Court. That is something that has been sacred into the last 10 years.
Right.
And the people that are getting positioned in that are for other purpose, not for the people, but for power, tyranny, if you will. And I think that we're heading in that direction. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to be the America our fathers were even born into.
I agree. I agree.
Thank you for that. I'm glad. Be aware.
Yeah. And I think, coming. You know, that's what happens with empires, right? Just like a drug empire. There's a parabolic move up, just like a stock. It's got to peter off and come down. It's what happened in Rome.
It does.
It's what happened in Greece. It's what happened with the Spaniards. You name it. So I think actually the South, the global South, is going to rise. I'm talking about these formerly dispossessed places.
It's
in Latin
already
America,
organizing right now.
Asia, God, Africa.
You're yeah. very tuned in. You're absolutely correct, and it is specifically the South.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. Texas is actually looking at seceding from the nation.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised at all if work is being done that we don't know about in that regard. What about Montana and Idaho?
Yeah, I wasn't really talking about that. I was talking about the meaning that in the political sense, the global South, the Southern Hemisphere.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Africa, parts of Asia.
You're not talking about America. Well, honey, baby, America's starting to divide too.
Yeah, sure. No, and I think that's just going to be real nasty. I don't know. I don't see that. I mean, it's possible that it pulls apart.
Hey, we had a civil war in 1863 sure. to 1867.
Right.
Maybe we can have it again.
Yeah. But look, in the near term, you're doing good work up there. You see now that you've been working on the ground with drug addicts, and when we say drug addicts, we mean
yes, the worst of the worst.
Teenage girls selling their bodies so they can smoke fentanyl. Like,
how
far have things gone off the rail when that happens as parents, as community, right? So I guess my question to you is like, you see that, but these are all drugs supplied at the top by the cartels that you used to run with. Like, do you think about that? You're like, wow, I'm seeing the devastation now.
Every day.
Yeah. So could you talk about like what's going on up in the Northwest, up in Seattle, and when it comes to like, how has the drug landscape changed?
Well, I can put it even more personal. My own son is a fentanyl addict. Son goes to get methadone every day of his life. God love him. And my own son struggles not only in his addiction, but in his environment, because this is the environment that we've allowed to manifest as a result of the introduction of these newer drugs that weren't around in my time of being in the business. The immorality, the lack of self-esteem that I see in so many people is like a cancer that's only spreading. It's not diminishing. It's the opposite. And I think that my calling, when I left my church as a pastor and decided to minister in the trap houses and in the camps, was almost like a self-inflicted punishment for the sins of my younger years of life. I needed to connect with what I had helped create.
Yes.
And God helped me for it. It's pretty ugly.
Yeah.
But you know what? You can't judge another person if you're going to survive in that ministry. Yeah. And my bishop asked me to train other people in our church to work in outreach services. And I told him that's impossible. I'm not going to stick somebody in there where someone might flip out on 5 days of meth and stick a knife in their throat because they think they're a narc.
Right.
And I said, that's the environment's dangerous every time you go in it.
Right.
And myself living that way all of my life, I don't feel really threatened because I can make moves I need to that are necessary before I end up in that situation.
And when you say camps, you're talking about homeless camps.
Yeah. Tent camps.
Okay. And where are those in Seattle? I imagine there's a lot.
Well, I'm in Snohomish County. So the Everett area, they're primarily under the Hewitt Avenue Bridge, 41st Street, out in the flats between Marysville and Everett. And then you have other spot camps, which are maybe three or four only tents that are together.
Yeah.
And those are usually down in culverts or places like that.
Right.
And yeah, they're there. But what I can say in benefit to Everett is I notice that we have less people sleeping on the sidewalks than we did 2 and 3 years ago.
Right.
I do see a diminishing. I see murals being painted on buildings that are very encouraging. I see flower pots, hanging flower baskets being put up on our streets. I see a pride even coming upon people that aren't fortunate enough to have a roof over their head.
Mm.
But yet you don't see a big mess when they leave an area like you used to 2 and 3 years ago.
Right.
So change is coming. I think that other options are being given to the homeless, especially the mentally afflicted, not necessarily drug addicted.
Right. What's the major reason for homelessness? Is it?
I would say drugs for sure.
More than mental illness?
Yes, but we have a lot of mental illness out there.
Right.
I'm counseling a few right now, and some of them are in their 60s and early 70s. They just can't survive anymore. And there's nobody that can treat them anymore. And we need to implement programs that will protect them and preserve them.
Yeah.
But you know, you also got to look at convalescent care. A lot of bad things go on in some of these convalescent houses, and it forces the elders to get away from that.
Right.
So where do they go? What options do they have? Their kids don't want them. Society doesn't want them.
Right.
And so people like me are blessed to have them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like I told you, every single day people knock on my door and they come for a meal, yes, but they come to be prayed with. They come to talk about their problems to a man that they have learned to trust in the community that's not going to go tell the police something.
Right.
That's not going to expose them in any way. I'm simply there to serve them.
Yeah.
They get their EBT food cards. They trade it for dope the day they get it, and then they starve an entire month.
Oh.
It's not my place, brother, to judge that. Yeah. It's my place to make damn good sure they get a meal because they're a human being,
yeah,
and they're entitled to be treated in such manner.
Right.
We need to get away from judging people on sight. Yeah. What we need to do is show actionability for accountability, mm-hmm, and show that our faith is not just being said by us, but let me show you.
Yeah.
Let me show you.
Right.
And to love one another as Christ loved us. It's very simple, really.
It really is. We can't quite grasp that yet and put it into practice as humans.
I think it's because we have to recondition the way we were raised and thought of. And I remember as a child, and you probably do too, you would hear people in your own family, oh, look at that person. They, you know, look at how horrible they look, or look at what they're doing, or thing. And after you hear that, over years and years of life, you start becoming imprinted by it.
Mm.
So that becomes a mindset.
Yeah.
And where I'm coming from now and have for 19 years this year is to go the opposite way and say, wow, look at that person. Wow, look at that. You know, they did something a little better today than they did yesterday.
Right.
And, oh, they brought another person to me today, yeah, instead of, oh, my God, here comes a new. I don't feel that. I don't have, yeah, that in my soul.
Well, I think we're conditioned that way too, just from survival. Like we see, yes, a homeless person or a drug addict and we subconsciously think, God, that could be us. And so we put an otherism between
us.
That's
true. I know, yeah, people that do look at it that way, yeah, actually.
Yeah. I felt the same way when I got out of prison myself. Like even when I was in prison, I was really like, oh, I'm not one of you fucking animals. You, yeah, know, like I'm a drug trafficker, you know, you're a, yeah, meth head.
I kind of sort of went through that same mindset. I get it.
You know what, yeah, I mean?
I do know what you mean.
Yeah. And it's because you're like, part of you is like, oh my God, like I am in prison. I am a loser. Yeah. You know, just like everybody that's in prison is now in some capacity is losing.
I went to school.
Yeah.
When I was in prison, I took it another way. I didn't feel like I was a loser, brother. I did, yeah, not.
And I should have had a stronger mindset. I just didn't because...
Well, you're a pretty intelligent guy. I'm surprised you didn't. But if you ever ended up, God forbid, in that situation, I bet you go a whole different path this time.
Yeah, I would.
Because you carry out that mindset when you leave the prison.
Yeah.
That's why we were training hospice counselors out of inmates.
Yeah.
They left with compassion instead of
totally.
Anger.
Totally. Yeah. I think I was so driven to win, to get out. I was like, shit, like I want to get my life going. I made the most of it. Like I manifested everything I'm doing now. I was like, I'm moving to LA. I'm going to get into show business. Nothing's going to stop me.
Yes.
I just think, if I went in now, I would go in with a much better attitude towards being confined. Like I had a real hatred for the guards. I had a hatred, yes, for the system. And I just wouldn't go in with that anymore. You, yeah, know, I just wouldn't do it because attitude determines how you get through anything.
You have more wisdom now of life.
Yeah.
And that's what is required. We learn from the things that Christ explained it really well. He says the greatest wisdom comes from the greatest suffering.
Yeah.
When you hurt yourself, don't you always remember that? Oh, my God, that hurt when I did that. Right.
Right.
So we gained a wisdom from it that's applied later in life.
Yeah.
And we can actually turn that into a benefit in a humanitarian sense.
Right.
Yeah. That's how I look at
it. Your first stretch at Folsom was not enough pain.
No, I had to go back to prison one more time. I had to try out the feds.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't my choice. I got a plane ticket and $5,000 in cash sent to me and my wife. Shortly after I got out, because I moved all the way to Washington State. I was in Sacramento at that time.
And right.
Went up there to get away from it, find somebody, fall in love, build a new life type thing. Yeah. Did it. And then one day I get an envelope in my box with $5,000 and two tickets to Las Vegas, Nevada, and said, hey, brother, meet me here at the Sands. And I thought, oh, this is cool. My compadre wants to, you know, see how I did.
Right.
I get down there and he says, well, if we got 200 kilos for you, you got to go to work. And I couldn't believe it.
Wow. Who's your compadre?
I'm not going to say his name.
Okay. Yeah. Well, did you know him from the early days?
I knew him from childhood days. Got I'm it. Protecting him.
Got it.
And he was in the same spot. He didn't want to either.
Wow.
But we don't say no.
And so you didn't say no.
And that's how it all started again.
Wow.
Of course not.
And then you had a hell of a run.
Yeah, we built quite a thing. We really did.
Now, what about the village? The village, what became of that?
That's good you brought that up. When I first went back to Mexico in 1974, 75, early 75, I went to the village, and they were the ones that said, well, we got this muerta. We need to move it in the States. So they were packing it, and at that time, they were only charging me $20 a kilo for marijuana.
Wow. And what are you selling?
But it's stems and seeds, and 600 a pound. Yeah, I mean, the market was phenomenal.
Oh,
and they said, bring a car back. Well, what happened was my market grew so rapidly that I contracted with two other guys, got their cars down there, and we're doing this. And I was buying up the village's weed. Well, they had other people that were getting that weed before they met me.
Right.
So they couldn't sell me everything. And I'm going, God, I need more. I need more.
Wow.
So that's how I ended up in Guadalajara and Jalisco with Rafael Cara Quintero.
Wow.
That's how that all happened.
So you were buying pot from Rafael?
Yeah, I'd buy out the damn village, and then we'd go and head to Jalisco and pick up weed outside of Guadalajara.
And was that Rafael's weed?
That was his weed.
Now, did you...
He left Sinaloa and was already living over there.
In Chihuahua, right?
Yeah. No.
Chihuahua's where he planted the first that...
That's the major gigantic... Right. This is years before that.
Okay, so had he made Sinsemilla yet or no?
We weren't getting if he had, but we were still getting that Mexican dirt weed.
Yeah.
And, you know, you bust down the bricks and there'd be dead birds or yarn or, you know, whatever in there that they were packing in that day. And, hey, for $20 a kilo, what the hell, you know?
Right. And it was the only thing moving in America. So, you know, it's going to sell.
Yeah. Northern California had started, but they were extremely high priced. You're talking the 70s.
Yeah.
And so we were still competitive in the market.
Wow. So how much weed... In that time, were you moving a month out of Mexico?
Oh, my God. Say we could do 2, 8, 60. So three times 160 kilos. So you're probably looking at over 500 kilos a month by that time. And having fun. We're playing.
You know,
we're just out there, college kids, getting rich, having, oh, my God, it was just a great time.
Getting rich. Wow.
Yeah, we weren't moving ton loads yet. We weren't involved in that level of life yet.
Yeah.
That came later.
500 bricks a month at...
that's a half a ton.
Yeah, at $500 profit.
Yeah, over 500 profit.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what did it cost you back in the early 70s to go from Sacramento to central Mexico? I mean, maybe $200, $250.
Right. Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah, you know? And you never got stopped once crossing.
I never got caught ever. None of my guys did either.
So you're making $250,000 a month moving bricks of weed.
Easily.
Yeah. Wow. And you got other white boys, other gringos working with you now,
they
right?
were with me. They were safe.
Yeah.
They were with me. They never got to meet anybody. What we did was get a motel. I'd have someone come and pick their cars up.
Right.
They'd load the cars and bring them back, keys in the car, and they would take off. I would go over there where they were loading because I wanted to say hi to my friends.
Yeah.
It was different, but I never exposed them, ever.
Yeah.
I think I sent you a photograph of two of them, one of the pictures. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, so one of the original white guys, because, you know, we've talked to a few guys your age and a little older, Richard Reeves, et cetera.
I saw the interview. Yeah.
There was this cast of characters of white guys, you know, that started working early with the Mexican organizations.
Yes.
Yeah. And the man, you guys you really had, you did what you wanted.
Yeah. Well, the law wasn't ready for us at that time.
Right.
They were not developed to the point where they are even 15, 20 years ago. They were developed by then to where they could stop the kind of foolishness that we just did was almost like a hobby.
Sure.
Yeah. You get to run down, you get to make a whole buttload of money. And at the same time, go see the world, you know, type thing. And it was really magical. It was addictive. That was the addiction.
Those are the good times before the cocaine.
Yeah. Before the cocaine.
Did you say you started flying in? So you started flying in kilos. Did you have a pilot's license or you'd hire the pilot?
No, I was VFR certified. Okay. Yeah. My first plane N7458 X-ray. I bought in Ukiah, California. It was 172 Skyhawk. And then I picked up a 185, and that's where I did my distance. But I would fly it from there, and my loads, I would come down to California when I was living north and do my drops in Arlington. And Pat Grady would meet me in Arlington and offload the planes, and I'd go back down for another.
And how many keys could those kind of planes hold?
Well, it wasn't how many they could hold, because they could have held more than we were doing. It's just what we could get on. And I would say some of the loads were 60, 80, you know, maybe 110 kilos. Okay. That's the most I could scrape together. And Pat, get them off to the market, you know, within a day or two.
Okay,
and,
yeah, so not very big loads.
No, that was big for us at the time.
Right.
It, very big for the Northwest at the
time.
No,
of course. It's a ton of coke, I'm just saying, compared to, you know, some of the other smuggling missions. Yeah.
Well, no, at the end, we were moving in the hundreds of kilos at a time.
Wow. Yeah, now, when you're coming into airspace like that, what was your cover? You know,
just inbound on final approach. How you guys doing, tower? You know, just really friendly, nice. And after a while, they kind of get familiar with your plane. So there's really nothing other than, hey, how's it going down there, Robert? And you know, first names of the people in the towers. And those were the years. Those were the days. Everything was laid back because they weren't looking for it at all.
Right.
You know, you're,
and
just
you're like 25. What's a 25-year-old kid got his own plane?
Yeah, I was about that age, actually.
What's a 25-year-old kid got his own plane for? Well, he's a rich kid, I guess. Okay. Yeah.
Nobody ever asked, and you never made relationships. You just taxied in. Pat would pull up, you know, there at the, where I would taxi over to, and we just unloaded. And
so did Pat have the accounts? Did he have the buyers on this side?
Pat was the one that helped me develop everything up
there. I see. Yeah. So he was crucial in your operation,
the creation of the organization.
Really? Yeah.
Later he wasn't. He didn't have the ability to work with people that had the kind of money that I worked with, because Pat was a user. He was a heroin addict from Vietnam.
Okay.
He picked it up in Nam. It never left him.
Oh,
he lived with the faces of the ghosts across the river, as he used to tell me.
Right.
But he was a good man, and he was a man that everybody trusted.
Yeah.
But he used drugs.
So did he just kind of get pushed out of the game because of his drug use?
Yeah, and he didn't mind it. He'd make the introductions for me. He would oversee certain things for me. Right. But he understood his role. He understood.
Right.
And I loved him. It didn't matter. You know, I just knew that people, you can't work with a drug addict when you're handing some guy $650,000.
No.
And, you know, he's all slammed up and nodding out in his car.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
No. Yeah. Were those the guys you came up with in Mexico that would become the drug lords and the junior drug lords? Didn't they all have bad cocaine habits, though?
No. We all went through the cocaine time where we all did.
Everybody did, yeah.
Sure, yeah. We were all packing our heads with that crap. But there came a time where you're going, you know, it was fun, but I don't want to do it anymore. And that's what it was with me.
Yeah.
I got tired of being high. I had other things I wanted to do with that money and other things that I was focusing on that I wanted to build.
Yeah.
I wanted the empire. I wanted to build something great. And I did.
Yeah.
And I'll always and forever be proud of it. God forgive me, but it's true. You know?
No, you did create something. I mean, it's a lot of work, and it takes skills to operate at that level, not just balls, but real acumen and awareness.
And you have three elements. You have law enforcement, you have raiders and robbers, and then you have the people you answer to, the cartel. Yeah.
Right.
And you have to stay focused at all times, because it only takes one mistake.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah. You barely made those mistakes.
I rarely made those mistakes.
Yeah.
If I got a bad feeling or didn't like somebody brought into me, I never saw them again.
Yeah.
I would just immediately kill that part of my life.
Right.
And I did that more than once.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, people see somebody successful, they get a tendency to become jealous of their success and they want it. And you have to start weighing in at that point, just how far do you want to take this?
Yeah.
Are you going to end up having to shoot this guy, or are you going to end up going to jail for this guy?
Yeah. Do you see now the cartels, it's mostly meth and fentanyl that they're pushing, right?
Yeah. And people. People's a big business.
People's a huge one. Yeah.
That's probably their biggest.
Yeah, they say that's their biggest moneymaker. Makes sense.
Well, yeah, you don't have to grow it in the ground. You don't have to cook it up in a lab.
You don't have to pay for the shipping of it. You know,
and as soon as it pays you. Yeah, as soon as it gets turned around, it comes right back to you and send it again.
Right.
Yeah, it's a scary business.
Yeah, totally. And everybody's in on it. Like, Mexico is developing at a rapid clip in many ways. You know, they just elected a female president.
Isn't that cool?
It is cool. It is. No. And she's
Jewish.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, this is amazing.
And
it's
super leftist, which I don't love, but whatever.
But
the people
love her and the people trust her.
Right.
Wasn't she the mayor of Mexico City? I believe that she was.
She might have been. She might have been.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, yeah. I thought so.
So, but you know, they're very good. That will be a big benefit to the cartel.
Exactly.
She's very pro-cartel. Not pro-cartel, but she's... The Morena Party is very... they go very easy on the cartel.
Of course they do. That's their money. That's that's their power.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, you're hand in hand with some formidable force that nothing can take out. But, you know, I got to give a lot of respect due to the Mexican police forces, the special forces specifically, yeah. the Mexican Marines that they have down there. These people do put it on the line, and they do take action, and they do succeed in their wars.
Absolutely.
It's pretty impressive.
Absolutely. You
know, we've never seen it like this before.
Well, what Ed Calderon was telling us is that since the Morena Party got back into power 5 years ago with the guy who's leaving office this year.
I loved his interview.
Thanks. Yeah, well, you should watch the one on Patreon. He tells us that because the Marines are the least corruptible of the Mexican law enforcement bodies, they've actually been removed from pursuing cartels by the Morena Party.
Yeah, I've
and the military's back in there, and they're all on the take. So there's some suspicious stuff. So my point is, like, it's crazy to see the country joining the modern world, but also like it not affecting cartel activity much at all. Like it's still a country with like endemic corruption. Like nothing operates down there without the authorities being paid off. You know,
that's never going to change. It might get less, but it will never, ever change because money corrupts everybody and everything.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you stop for 1 second? Thank you, brother. I've got to make a quick call here. Just, I don't know where they're at, but I'm going to let them know to start heading this way.
Yeah. Yeah. We only got about 20 minutes left.
Yeah. So. That's why I was doing it now. Cool. And thank you. Let me just take this.
I actually have a good question. I remember that I wanted to ask you from the original, from the episode.
Of course. Come on. Okay. Hola, compadre. Are you guys still in the area? Okay, I'm still, we're wrapping up our second interview right now, about 15, 20 minutes, and I'll be ready.
Yeah, 15.
Okay, I'll keep the phone on, just give me a call when you're out front. Okay, you better got me some church's chicken, I'm starving. I'll give you a call when I'm done. All right, bye. Thank you for
2018. 2018 is when you stopped working, right? You retired from from working as a mercenary. You mentioned on the free episode, you said, I'll ask it again.
I'm sorry. Jesus Christ. My phone is just unloading a ton of stuff. Okay.
All right. Okay. Something that I forgot to ask you to elaborate on in the main episode.
Okay.
When you retired in 2018, as soon as Chapo got extradited from Mexico to the US, the Sinaloa cartel completely splintered.
It did.
And to this day, they're not a hierarchy anymore. A non-vertical.
Well, you are familiar with Los Chapitos.
Totally.
The sons of El Chapo.
And they're being dominated by Mayo.
Yeah, Mayo Zambada.
And then there's other factions too, and they both have like armed gangs that call themselves something different. So we've been studying this stuff through the course of doing this show. They're no longer a hierarchy.
Right.
Which is the reason they survive. Yeah. But why were you shipped out of there so quickly after they shipped Chapo?
I was going to get killed. I mean, the gunfire was, like I said, within the same block of me, and they were killing people. And here they got this gringo down there. It didn't matter that I was a pastor.
Right.
I'm just a white guy in their backyard at a time that the boss has just been extradited into America.
Right. So it's chaos. Everybody's
jockeying.
It was
chaos. It was great. We went to the graveyard site, and I'm praying blessings over where his mother's body was being laid. In the background, we're listening to automatic weapons fire, and that's not even downtown Obregon.
Wow.
And the neighborhood that he lived in and that he grew up in was the old part of the colonial part of the town, if you can envision that. And I mean, we had a photograph of a guy walking up and shooting a guy in the head on that block who was kissing his wife goodbye, leaning his head out of his pickup, and was shot right in the head right there.
And is that just because when the boss is finally done, all these groups are jockeying?
Vendettas. It's a chance for people to go ahead and get their revenge.
Oh, I see.
Control has been momentarily taken from them.
Wow.
And that is the culture of the gangs, as you were speaking, not the cartels, but the gangs.
Right.
Now we got our chance to pay back for these guys.
Nobody's in charge. I'm going to kill this guy because I've been waiting on it.
Right. And that's right. And that's what was happening the very days I was down there. And it was hairy. It was hairy getting out of there. I mean, I was hidden in the trunk of a car.
Yeah.
You know, and they were stopped twice getting out of the city of Obregon and flagged through because they were either recognized or whatever. I don't know. I was in the trunk of a car.
So there's armed sentries just stopping cars.
Stopping cars, looking for enemies, looking for whatever. We didn't know. They were just a simple family that were not connected to anything. They were just normal people.
Yeah.
And that's probably the other reason why they were flagged through, because they were cars were stopped because they were looking for somebody or somebody affiliated or whatever.
Right.
These people didn't fit the profile. They were flagged through. But, boy, I remember, I mean, it was tripping me out because they would open up that trunk and there's a white guy in the trunk.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, it would have been over.
Yeah.
It would have been over.
For sure.
I quit the next day.
So did you just say it's too hot? It's.
Yeah, I explained to the agents. I said, look, I think I'm a little bit too old for it this time. I've given you 17 years. We've done great things. And I want to live a little longer. And I just don't feel that I'm all the way at my best doing this anymore.
Right, sure.
Once you're at the edge of you, once it starts to crumble, it's time to get the hell out of there.
Yeah,
it's,
again, your instincts. You're like, my instincts aren't as good. You had that instinct. Yes. You're like, I'm not sharp anymore.
That's exactly what it was.
Right.
Well said.
Wow. Dude, that goes to show you how much power, if they want to, though, those organizations have down there, is they can just take over a city.
They did take over that city. Crazy.
They did in Culiacan for... a couple of days.
Oh my God. My memories of Culiacan. I can honestly tell you, brother, I can't remember any time going to that city where I didn't hear gunfire somewhere in the distance.
Not really?
Any time.
See, we were down there and I know it's a different day, different era, but
yeah, it's been 20 something years since
we found it incredibly safe, clean. Because
that's not the Culiacan that I remember.
Okay, yeah. How was Culiacan back in the 70s and 80s?
The Wild West. I mean, literally, there were bodies dropping every day, sometimes two or three a day. It wasn't like big giant numbers like Juarez, you know, when Juarez had that bad year.
Yeah.
But it was every day, every day. And hearing gunfire in the distance was every day that I was there. Hell, I got blown off a road and kidnapped. I mean, it just, as you know.
Oh, right. Yeah. Of course.
I mean, every day.
Yeah.
Every day.
I wonder what that was over.
Mexican federal agents didn't want me to meet the general in the army. They were told by the drug cartel, grab that son of a bitch and find out what he knows before you kill him.
Oh, right. Of course.
That's exactly what it was over.
I meant just the generalized violence back then, because now we were told that it's one of the safer cities because the Sinaloa cartel has such a stronghold on it. There's no violence because they have a monopoly on all of it.
I don't have knowledge anymore, but that doesn't surprise me. They are the power, and that is the hub of the Sinaloa drug cartel.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of time in Culiacan, and I've never seen it like that.
Yeah.
I'd almost like to go back and see that, but I'm targeted now, bro.
Yeah, you probably can't. It's not worth it.
I don't think we're going to go down there.
It's we liked it. It's just kind of a small...
That's cool you've been there. I didn't know you'd seen Culiacan.
Yeah, we went down there in around Thanksgiving of 2022. The show had just started, and we wanted to go down there with our buddy Luis, who's a journalist in Mexico.
Yeah.
And he said, they're growing legal weed now. Like, they're starting to open up dispensaries. Yeah. It's not quite legal, but they think it's on its way. Yeah. And so what the organization, the Los Chapitos, were doing is opening up very visible, open to the public pot dispensaries like you have all over America now and on the West Coast.
I did not know that.
And we were like, that's fascinating.
That's beyond fascinating. That's amazing.
We went down and we saw like a weed house where these young, Culiacaneses are growing all this pot that's essentially, it's not legal, but it's being sold like it's legal. And we got, there's a picture of me holding a Mac 10 and it was fucking bizarre.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It was bizarre. But, and we went out and met some guys that are actually guarding Mayo because we went out to the countryside. So the Chapitos.
You were taken out.
We were taken out
to
the countryside.
You were allowed to go out.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very fascinating to me.
Yeah, yeah. And we couldn't film anything. Yeah. We couldn't film their faces, but they were all sniffing coke and, you know, like.
Boy, that's totally different than my time down there. People weren't getting high at all that I was around.
Okay.
Yeah. Soldiers were soldiers. You know, you would get shot and killed by your bosses if you were.
Clearly. And then you saw a guy getting eaten by Rottweilers.
Yes, I did.
For wearing gold. So, I mean, I don't know which one is worse, but yeah, everybody there, these are young kids. Yes. I mean, when I say kids, I mean, they're 22 to 25.
They're kids.
They got braces.
They're sicarios.
Yeah, sicarios. And
in training.
But there's a lot of times there's nothing to do. They're just sitting around strapped or straps are close to them and they're passing around coke, just casually sniffing. There's no women around.
Yeah.
It's all men. And there's little kids in this little village and they're singing like narco theme songs.
You guys were in cartel land.
We were deep.
You were deep.
And then get this, 2 months later, in January of 23 is when they raided and arrested Ovidio.
Wow. You were connected to that time.
Yes,
when that happened.
Exactly.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I watch the news and I see these familiar faces and names come up all the time. And it's just, wow.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when he was nothing but a lieutenant, you know,
right.
And now they're lords, you know, right. Because, you know, El Chapo, he's, you know, 50 feet underground in Florence, Colorado, in the ultra maximum security prison.
Yeah.
His days are done. I knew someone who knew someone that had been in there, and his letters come in on a TV screen in his room. He can't even hold the letters where his wife writes him.
Right.
You know, the shower thing, you step into this booth that comes in front of your cell and it moves to the next cell. And
I've
the
heard
next,
that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's real.
It's death. It's death.
It's living death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's why you're like, why would anybody let themselves be taken? Yeah. If you know you're really marked to be extradited, if you stay in Mexico, do your time there. That's one thing. But if I was like a high level target that not even like a
shoot
leftist.
It out and die.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Or turn it on yourself. I don't know. You know, but anyways, he probably didn't think he was good. Maybe he did, though. I don't know. You know, what's funny is that I didn't ask you this because I respect your boundaries.
Thank you.
It's likely that Chapo or somebody in that organization told those Rottweilers to go eat this guy because he was showing too much shine and flash. And then 30 years later, he's on Twitter. And he's on the run in Mexico and he's doing interviews with Sean Penn and he's, you know, in magazines with like soap stars and people are like, what are you doing? You're being hunted.
He was anticipating them catching him. He was anticipating, he wanted his story told and that's why he took the chance.
Sure. But I mean, it's like, tell the story and then get off Twitter.
Yeah.
Why are you have a smartphone on you? I would be so far in the jungle. You would just never, I don't care if I have to camp the rest of my life.
You're smart enough to know better.
Well, but you know who's doing that now is Mencho.
Yeah. Yeah. Was that your story? I saw that not too long ago on one of my podcasts that I monitor.
I don't know if we've talked about Mencho
out yet?
Recently.
Yeah,
I don't know
if
we've
talked about him. Yeah, it might have been Pete Turner's.
But yeah, it sounds like it. But Mencho, they say, is dead. That's the rumor. And he's probably not dead. He's probably living.
He said that about Chapo once, too.
Exactly.
He set up his own death.
Like, that's what you need to do. Like, the only guy who's left standing is still a figurehead that's out there is Mayo.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, did you ever meet?
No.
You never met him?
I know who he is.
Of course.
A lot of people I didn't meet in those earlier years, but it's really interesting to watch the news now and say, oh, God, I remember them talking about him.
Right.
You know, and I have that knowledge.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Did you work in Medellin?
No, I did not. I've been to Colombia before, but I did not work down there in undercover capacity.
What were you doing there?
Going down there with a friend that had a DC-3 picking up 1,200 kilos of cocaine. I went with him one time, and God almighty, I'd never go back there and do it again. We landed in El Rio Negro. That was just outside of Medellin. And he picks us. I mean, these guys come out of the woodwork with automatic weapons and screaming and yelling and telling us, you're taking this. I mean, he was in the back strapping these kilos down.
Wow.
It's in one of my reports. But anyway, he's strapping this stuff down, and they're trying to get us to fire up the plane and go while we're still strapping down bundles.
Yeah.
And he eventually got busted in Pennsylvania. His plane blew out, and he had to land in America just before he's crossing into Canada, and that's how they got him. But the flight that I did with him, we went all the way north.
Oh,
yeah.
So you
never
made it
again. I did it one time.
It from Medellin to Canada?
We made it from Medellin to Canada. Yeah. Well, he had bladder bags, and a lot of us pilots use bladder bags when you're flying. Bladder bags are extra fuel.
Oh,
it's a big bag full of fuel, so you don't ever have to make a diversion.
So you made it.
That's old
direct.
School, bro. That's direct.
Correct. My God. Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. Well, where do you land?
That's a DC-3. Oh, he landed an airstrip.
He landed
in a legal airstrip.
Right.
Yeah, a legitimate one in Canada.
In BC?
No. We were on the East Coast. I can't remember the town, but it was a legal airstrip.
Holy
but everybody was paid off. And yeah. Like
in
I
Canada.
Said, I only did that one time, brother.
How much can you buy? So that, but that must have been a profitable flight.
God, it was almost 40 years ago. It was a long, long time ago in a land far, far away. And I just got invited to jump in the plane. And oh, why not? You know, I've never done this. And one of the stupid, you do a lot of stupid things as you come up in life.
Yeah.
When you're around the people that are doing dangerous things like that. And you yourself live a dangerous life.
Yeah.
But it is documented. That story is documented.
Wow.
Because he ended up rolling over on everybody and he did rap my name off. So there is a record of it. But one time.
Yeah.
One time.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was the extent of your relationship in Colombia.
Yeah.
Wow. That's interesting. Now, would, just a couple more questions. Would the Mexicans, if they found out that you went around them and went straight to Colombia to do a deal, would there be a problem?
I wasn't really involved in the deal. He just asked me if I wanted to go along for the ride. I jumped in a plane, you know, I did something stupid, you know, but, no, I wasn't going around anybody.
Okay.
I was just in for the ride.
Right.
Yeah, sure. Colombia. Yeah. Let's go try that.
Right.
And that's how we were in our younger years of life. We were making foolish decisions. I'm sure you probably understand that.
Totally. I would never jump in a plane, even at 23 or 24, going to Colombia for a bunch of dope. If I didn't expect to make money out of it, I would ask what I was making per piece.
No judgment.
Yeah. But, but didn't that thought come to mind though? You're like, shit, I can get a better price on each kilo if I go down further south.
No, I would never have stepped away from what I was doing.
Got it.
I was simply along for the ride.
Right. And you had no risk. They were delivering by the end. They were bringing the bricks to you. Why?
My brother, it was totally risky, that flight. I mean, I didn't even know why I did it.
Totally risky.
On the impulse, did it.
Right.
Yeah. That was also at the time they were still getting, what do they call them? They weren't called flats of hash. What did they call it when hashish was coming into Canada? Pallets, but it wasn't called pallets.
I don't know.
There was a name for it.
Oh, I don't know.
Were getting that in Vancouver, those beautiful, beautiful blacks of the best. I mean the best.
Hash
Gold
blocks.
Seal black, choking red.
Where was that
Lebanese, from Lebanon and
those
countries there.
Wow.
And Gold Seal black was opium-laced hash with either a pyramid, the eye symbol, or a camel stamped on them.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you move hash at all?
A little bit, but it wasn't my business. What I did mainly was I bought it for enjoyment, and then I would sell some to friends.
Yeah.
But I would keep for me.
Yeah.
Vancouver was really known for hash for quite a while.
Totally. I remember that.
Yeah, you do your North Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Good hash, wasn't it?
Yeah. Fuck yeah, it was. Fuck yeah. Oh, it was too good. Just blasted out of my mind.
In truth, that was probably the only time I ever did something foolish in the years that I was already kind of climbing the ladder.
Yeah.
Was jumping in the way. And I did it because it was more of a challenge than anything. It was like, are you going to do this or not type thing. Oh, hell yeah, I'll do anything. And I jumped in and we made it out of there. I mean, but I did not like it. And I would never go back there again. I mean, they were not like in Mexico when I would land, everything was calm. Like, you know, the fuel truck would come out and they'd crank gas in my wings and fill my tanks and everybody was cool. And then you were gone down there. They're coming out shooting guns and being crazy.
Really?
They're all excited about the plane getting there. Let's hurry these gringos up and get this load back there. And he had been doing several of them. He went down finally, like I told you, in a Pennsylvania field. But Jesus, God almighty, just totally not my back.
So the Colombians were the cowboys, even though, there's always like that debate. Who had their shit together more, the Mexicans or the Colombians? Well,
that's why they call it the University of Medellin. Colombia taught the Mexicans the business, business.
Right. Man, what a great afternoon.
Yeah, thank
you.
What
a great afternoon hanging out with you. Go check out Hal's books. Can you shout out your website one more time?
Yeah, it's lowercase drhalbradley.com. And that takes you right to the Amazon site. And to all the books, it also gives a brief synopsis of my history, who I am.
Yeah.
So I welcome you to it. I thank you for checking it out, and I thank you for having me on your show.
And we thank you. Again, that's drhalbradley.com, drhalbradley.com. The link will be in the description. A fox inside the lions, in the lion's den, a fox in the lion's den. Can't wait to read it. And then, you know, he's got plenty of other books too that I'm going to read because
thank you.
We're going to get the stories we didn't quite get out of you today because they're confidential.
They're going to be very familiar to you, brother.
Yeah.
From our interview, a lot of what I shared with you is in those books.
No, congratulations.
Thank you, brother.
And yeah, we will see you guys later. Thank you, Patreon. Peace out. Bye-bye.
Okay.